row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. And inch by inch and row by row, someone bless these seeds I sow. Someone warm them from below till the rains come and tumble them down.
Welcome to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a production of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. We are Teresa Golden and Jean Thomas, Master Gardener volunteers. We discuss gardening issues seasonally and describe the events and educational services we provide. The seasoning segments appear on a timely basis, according to what's happening in our gardens during the year. Outstanding in their field segments are an opportunity to introduce our most outstanding volunteers individually. Cross-pollinating stories will discuss the activities of master gardeners in additional roles. We have master foresters and master naturalists included in our membership, as well as master beekeepers. We even have brewmasters. There are other offerings available from Cooperative Extension, and we will periodically be chatting with representatives of the busy 4-H program and the Taste of New York market, as well as the various offerings for assistance with family life, from child care to budget planning. From time to time, we will go live for a call-in show when a particularly urgent topic arises. The podcast of Digging In with Master Gardeners is available through this station and via a link on our own website at ccecolumbiagreen.org/gardening. Welcome to another episode of Digging In with Master Gardeners on WGXC Radio 90.7 FM. We're a production of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Greene and Columbia Counties. We're Jean Thomas, Master Gardener Volunteer, and Donna Peterson, Master Gardener Volunteer Coordinator in the Twin Counties. You can contact us on our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org or email the Master Gardeners at colgremg@cornell.edu.
Today we're talking with Teresa Golden, who you'll know as being one of our hosts. We've turned tables a little today. Teresa is the creator of a presentation we use with groups and for classes, and the topic is defensive gardening. So, Teresa, why do we have all of these conflicts with wildlife today?
Well, we all love to watch nature in our backyards. Wildlife plays vital roles in natural and cultural environments. You know that animals eat plants and other animals. They help fertilize the plants with their droppings. They're also valued for their beauty and grace, as well as the utilitarian benefits they provide. So today, in today's environment, especially in the country, we get to enjoy seeing turkeys roosting in the fields, ducks and geese flying in and out of ponds, red-tailed hawks, turkey vultures, herons, and sometimes eagles soar above us in the skies. Songbirds are constant visitors. Raccoons, red foxes, and opossums stop by. Skunks make their presence known more ways than one. Plenty of woodchucks, rabbits, gray squirrels, and chipmunks share a patch of ground. Owls keep us awake at night. Woodpeckers pound holes in decaying trees. And deer are everywhere. Turkeys are becoming less wild around us. Beavers build dams and creeks. Coyotes have become commonplace. Black bears have multiplied. So as you can hear, wildlife in Columbia and Greene counties is all around us. Now, if you think about it, people now share the landscape with millions of deer, geese, wild turkeys, etc. But when the Europeans first came to North America, several million North Americans and perhaps 30 million wild-tailed deer lived together in eastern forests. In the early 20th century, however, due to the clearing of land for agriculture and unrestricted hunting, the deer population in New York especially was reduced to less than 20,000 deer, with only about 500,000 deer nationally. Due to the wide range of conservation measures and the lack of natural predators, today in the same region of the U.S., eastern U.S., We are back up to more than 30 million deer who share the eastern forest landscapes with 200 million people. So one of the reasons for conflicts with wildlife is the way people have carved up the landscape, creating more habitat where wildlife can also thrive.
So let's dig into the biggest of these menaces. Why are deer so problematic?
Gosh, you know, some people love deer, but other people hate them because annual estimates of deer damage exceed $2 billion. They impact people, crops, timber and forest, and landscapes. Did you know that there's more than 50,000 deer vehicle collisions annually just in New York State, resulting in 29,000 injuries and approximately 200 deaths? Most of these collisions occur early in the morning or at dusk, especially between October and December. I know because I've had personal experience with at least two of those collisions.
So have I.
Deer are also known for their distribution and transmission of Lyme disease. That results in 25 to 28,000 human cases a year. And the high density of deer browsing also reduces the diversity in the forest understory. It enables invasive species to outcompete natives and prevents seedlings for many species from growing into the next generation of trees. So they really do have some negative ramifications.
So when their numbers are controlled in the environment, what makes deer special?
Well, deer are actually quite amazing animals. They're quite adaptable creatures, having evolved for over 4 million years. They've been humanized due to the popular movie Bambi, which gave the animal and others some clear emotions, clearly human emotions. While some consider deer to be magical, the reality is they are just mammals native to North, Central, and South America. Some interesting and unique capabilities about deer is that they've got a 310-degree field of vision, and their pupil lets in 9 times more light than ours. So it allows for them to have very good night vision. They have 2-color vision with blue and yellow primaries, so they very poorly distinguish between oranges and reds. And that's one of the reasons hunters always wear orange when they're out in the woods. So humans can see, other humans can see them, but the deer really can't. Their ears rotate a full 180 degrees. Enabling them actually pinpoint sources of sound. The average fawn weighs only 4 to 8 pounds, and they really are adorable. But if you do see a fawn, leave it alone. The mom is not that far away. The adult doe weighs between 100 and 200 pounds, with bucks weighing about 125 to 200 pounds. Bucks grow antlers annually, beginning in late spring. And they make rubs with their antlers to strip bark off, or that strip off bark of small diameter trees, but that helps the deer mark their territories. The females give birth to 1 to 3 spotted fawns in mid to late spring. The males leave their mother after a year, with females leaving after 2. They've got a beautiful reddish-brown coat in spring and summer that turns gray-brown in fall and winter, and that has insulating hollow hairs that basically allows them to, you know, survive the winter. They're faster and more agile than we are. If you ever watched a deer run through the woods, you can definitely tell that they're very agile. And they smell food, water, or danger from a mile downwind. So if you think about it, they're actually quite amazing animals. But it's simply not easy to be a deer. Most fawns born in the spring never live to see their first snowflake. They freeze and starve during long, cold winters. And one study said 64% of their morbidity was due to predators, bears and coyotes primarily, with 15% harvested by hunters and between 17 and 24% killed by vehicle collisions. So they've got it. They don't have it as easy as we often think they do. So while they live on the edges of forests, they've actually adapted quite well to the suburban landscape. The challenge is they consume about 3% of their body weight daily, which is 4 to 10 pounds of food.
Each
every day. They have a preference for legumes, grasses, clover, acorns, fruit, corn, twigs, leaves, and buds. But their diets vary by season and availability of food sources. They've got a four-chambered stomach, which enables the digestion of a variety of food. And their digestive microbes actually change with the seasons. So that's one of the reasons why you really shouldn't feed deer corn in the middle of the winter, because they really can't digest it well. They definitely prefer tender new growth, but they can also eat things like mushrooms and poison ivy. They can have all of that they want. But as the forests were carved into smaller and smaller parcels, this food tends not to be available in small woodlots and suburbs, which is why lawns, hedges, and flower beds attract deer. And you can just imagine how inviting a garden bed looks to a deer when they are hungry.
Thank you for listening to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, with offices in Hudson in Columbia County and Acre in Greene County. You can learn more about the Cooperative Extension by visiting the website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. If you have a gardening question or would like to suggest a topic for a future radio show, you can also email us at colgremg@cornell.edu. Today's topic is defensive gardening, and we're joined by Teresa Golden, a Master Gardener volunteer. Let's dig right back in, shall we?
Okay, now that we know how deer fit into our daily lives, what can we do about gaining control over our gardens? What are the main battlefields?
Well, there's a couple, more than a couple things to consider. Number one, though, is diet. And what I say by that, it's their diet, not ours. Number two is how they gain access to our gardens and yards. And what we can do to make perhaps our gardens and yards a little less attractive. And third, it's really about fences or barriers we can construct. And while we're talking specifically about deer right now, the same approaches will be successful with a little modification with other critters out there that are interested in the result of our hard work.
Let's start with the diet.
Okay. Deer, if they're hungry enough, will eat just about any plant. Recently, some of us have noticed grazing damage on yucca plants, which is known by the nickname of Adam's needle. They are hard-textured, spiny plants full of stringy fibers and should have absolutely no appeal to deer. But they browse on them anyway. They have seasonal things they eat in the wild, from grasses and tree buds in the spring through a summer of eating anything green, and in the autumn, they love acorns and mushrooms. In the winter, they'll basically eat anything that will provide nourishment. So that's when they go after a lot of the bark of trees and twigs and things like that. So it really does vary considerably. And as I mentioned before, realize that their digestive microbes do change by the season, which is one of the reasons that their diet changes as well.
So our gardens and yards appeal to them like a Las Vegas buffet does to us. Well, most of us anyway.
Well, one thing we can do is to make our plants less appealing to them. And you can do that by carefully selecting what plants you put in the ground. Bear in mind, however, that deer don't always read the labels telling them that they won't eat a particular plant. So understand that it's rules of thumb you have to go by. From a rule of thumb perspective, deer tend to avoid certain types of plants. Number one, things like daffodils are toxic to them, so they will definitely avoid those. They don't tend to like fuzzy plants, so lamb's ear is a good example. Lavender is another one. They don't like plants that have very strong aromas, so parsley, fennel, any of the mints, sages, they tend to stay away from. And while they may nibble on strong tasting plants, once they get a bite of them, they tend to move on. And those are things like garlic and alliums. And they also tend to avoid prickly leaves. So example is a spruce tree. Now, I won't say they won't eat a spruce tree, Again, depends how hungry they are, but they will tend to avoid things like that. And boxwood, and there's a couple of others that similarly. The Cooperative Extension website includes a list of deer-resistant plants that might be of interest. That can be found on ccecolumbiagreen.org. That said, bear in mind that because deer don't read any of these deer-resistant lists, experiment to see what works in your own yard, because when deer are hungry, they will eat anything. I've had them eat my Pachycandra, my Forsythia, you name it.
My peonies.
My holly, which I'm shocked. Yeah. Right. Okay, so access to our yards and gardens is key.
Most of us in the Twin Counties, even in the cities, live close to some area where deer can shelter. We all have stories of deer prancing around downtown or jumping in front of cars for sport. They can disappear in a hedgerow between houses as you watch. You just have to think of ways to remove our property from the regular circuit.
So what's the answer?
Barriers can either be physical like fences or sensory like repellents, or probably both to some degree. If you're growing food for yourself, the magic word is fence. A nice unprotected tomato plant with lots of fruit doesn't have a chance. In fact, you'll probably be eaten before it even makes any fruit. So if you're one of the fortunate few who've never had deer eat their unfenced produce, you must have lived anywhere else beside during that time. There's three primary types of deer fencing in use today. There's woven wire, or also polypropylene mesh. The woven wire is about $6 to $8 a foot plus labor to install, while the polypropylene mesh is only about $2 to $3 a foot plus labor. A 6 to 7 foot fence should be adequate for most homeowners, but if the deer pressure is very high, the fence might have to be as high as 8 feet. The second type is a high tensile electric fencing. This has a much higher installation cost and does require regular maintenance due to heavy snow and dry soil conditions. And the third type is more of a temporary fence. That's a polytape electric fence. It works best under very light deer pressure during the summer and the fall. What happens is you put peanut butter or something like that to entice the deer to sniff the fence, where they get shocked and hopefully learn to avoid the fenced area.
Whoa.
You can fence an entire garden or a yard, or you can just fence individual trees. In the case of trees, make sure the fence is higher than the browse line, which is about 5 feet from the ground to the lower limbs.
And you might want to consider the distance from the trunk. You don't want the fence right up tight to the trunk, because then they're just going to stand on their hind legs and reach over it. You need some distance back away from the trunk to extend the safety zone.
Because otherwise the deer will just mess up your fence.
Mm, they lean.
So what do you mean by sensory barriers?
By that I mean mostly repellents. Think of repellents as behavior modifiers. There's dozens of products that are available to repel deer. All of them have some kind of claim that either they smell so bad or taste so bad that the critters basically go elsewhere without dining on your own garden. They all work to some degree. However, once the deer become accustomed to the smell and the taste, they begin to ignore it. So one of the keys with any kind of repellents is rotate them. Don't use the same repellent month after month, year after year. Some other methods can be visual or just startling to the deer. So flapping ribbons or pie tins around a target plant might work. Or it could be mechanical things like radios that play at random times, or spray guns that go off whenever a beam is broken. Over time, one of two things can happen. Either the deer becomes accustomed to the racket, or some poor soul accidentally walks into the yard and gets sprayed or deafened by the traps. So, you know, there's pluses and minuses to all of these. The key with repellents is please, please, please make sure to read the labels to make sure it's approved for New York State. And some repellents should never be used with edible plants. So again, make sure to read the labels. And also focus on how often the repellent needs to be applied. Some only last until the next rainfall. Others can be effective 6 to 8 weeks or longer. So again, read the label.
So I guess we're all doomed then, huh?
No, not at all. The fundamental question you have to ask yourself is how much time and or money are you willing to invest to preventing damage to your garden? Options range from live and let live, and I know some people who just plant extra, hoping that something's going to survive the deer barrage. Or you can put fencing up, but it's relatively expensive. Or you can use repellents or scare tactics, but recognize that they will be time intensive. So it's one of those trade-offs you have to make. We can't relax, but with the correct fencing, we can protect our vegetables. We can spray appropriate repellents and put up temporary barriers when the fruit trees in the yard begin to ripen. We can use plants that are more resistant to deer browsing. We have to be conscious of when the deer are going to be, you know, really behaving naturally to them, but behaving in different ways. So in the spring, you know, expect to babysit a fawn or two while mama goes off to feed in somebody else's yard. In winter, you may see the deer gathering around your bird feeders. There are certain birds who kick seed off the feeder for them. Everybody has some acceptance level of coexistence. And so, it's a matter of living and let living.
This is Digging In with Master Gardeners, a production of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Greene and Columbia Counties, brought to you by WGXC Radio, 90.7 FM. I'm Donna Peterson from Cornell Cooperative Extension, and I'm here with Master Gardener volunteers Teresa Golden and Jean Thomas. Today's topic is defensive gardening. We've already discussed deer, so let's dig in further.
So wildlife browsing resistance varies with changes in wildlife populations, availability of alternative foods, and environmental conditions. There's lots of wildlife candidates to talk about besides deer. So let's go in alphabetical order for some others. Jean's favorite is bears.
Yes.
The rest of the attackers are pretty small, but these guys deserve to be included. They can be dangerous, but most of us have enough sense to give them space. The reason they're a problem is the fact that humans are encroaching on their territory and providing lots of temptation. Once a bear has learned the locations of tasty garbage cans and compost piles, they will return often. Once they find your bird feeders, they'll make seasonal reservations at the snack bar. After the first visit by a bear, usually we take preemptive measures, but they have long memories. Remember, if all you do is wait a season, the bear may come shopping again at the same spot. If you leave your bird feeders up too late in the spring or put them out too early in the fall, a bear will find them. In the spring, they're very, very hungry. And in the fall, they're also very, very hungry. In the spring, they're empty. And in the fall, they're filling the tank to hibernate. So don't leave taste treats out if you're in any area where bears have been sighted, and there are plenty in both counties.
So what time of year is it actually safe to put a bird feeder out?
Let's see. Usually they recommend starting in late April, early May, and take them in once. I use as a rule of thumb when the acorns start dropping, because that's when everybody is starting to feed up for the winter. So Okay. Then again, when it gets cold enough, when you've got the ground frozen, and you can assume that the bears have gone to sleep, then it might be safe. Unfortunately, with climate change, it's an issue because we have longer mild seasons in the winter. So it may turn out to be a whole new change of approach the way that we're going to be feeding the birds.
It seems that this year, too, October is going to be warm all the way up until the end. So Yeah. You're 100% right.
Yeah.
The rule of thumb, I think, used to be December 1st or after the first snowfall might be a safe time to put the bird feeders back up. But until then, keep them down.
Yeah, it's getting looser and looser to know. And unfortunately, in both counties, the bear population is expanding.
I've expanded. Yeah. I have a mama and three cubs on my property.
Yeah, so. And we've got two family units crisscrossing each other's paths in my neighborhood.
Yeah, so the nice thing is that deer do tend to avoid people.
Not at my house.
most of the time. So it's
well,
one of those
the bears
things.
The bears are shy,
right?
So if you yell at them, they'll run away. But you don't really want to be having
no,
especially in the spring.
Yes.
Give them good distance. You never want to get between a mother and her cubs.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
So how about chipmunks?
Oh, they're so cute. Those little cheeks are adorable, and they're so very busy, and they're so very fertile. If they behaved more like Chip and Dale, the Disney characters, we'd be fine. All they ever eat is nice acorns. They don't climb up your tomato plants and take one bite, or get inside the walls of your house and bowl with hickory nuts in the middle of the night. I sound bitter, don't I? Happy news.
Experience.
A mature chipmunk can have a territory of up to a half acre. Their burrow homes can be as much as 30 feet in length and 3 feet in depth. They're pretty formidable. They're not really bad neighbors in general, however. They are important members of the ecology and contribute more than they cost in general. They're best dealt with by environmental modification. As a pest inside the house, you can find their entry points and block them physically. They're influenced by repellents, so keeping up a policy of spraying or dropping granules of repellents can be effective. Same as with the deer, they're a little more sensitive than the deer are, so they don't get acclimated as quickly, but do change what you're using semi-regularly. You know, when you use up a container of a particular repellent, switch and use a different combination of ingredients.
And they seem to be more susceptible to taste repellents as opposed to the scare tactic ones.
Yeah, they're more curious than the deer. Yeah, and it's hard to scare a chipmunk. I mean, they spend their whole life being afraid. So expanding out from the house for prevention, keep the bird feeders at least 15 feet from the house so the spilled seed doesn't lure them in closer. Those same bandit birds kick seeds out for them too, apparently. And store the seed in metal containers, not plastic or paper. They will chew through. If they disturb your bulb plantings, use a system of protecting the bulbs by installing chicken wire under the soil when you plant. As a last resort, and if you aren't squeamish, rat traps work and will reduce a population pretty well.
Yeah, we've had some luck with that, so I agree that does work. What about moles?
Moles.
And we might as well talk about voles since everybody confuses them anyway.
Okay. First, the mnemonics. Moles eat meat. Voles eat veggies. So keep your alphabet sorted out and you'll know which one's doing what. They look a whole lot alike, so that helps to distinguish them. Moles eat insects, earthworms, and other invertebrates like the little pill bugs and things like that that live in the soil. Sometimes they will expand their diet to seeds, roots, or bulbs. As a result, they're generally beneficial. We run into conflict when the mole population expands from their usual perimeter habitations into the lawn or garden. When they're boring through the nice soft soil searching for food, they throw up dirt volcanoes and make ridges in the earth. Fortunately, their population never gets large, and removal of just a few can alleviate the problem. Removal can be a challenge. There are poisons to be used by professionals or repellents that can be complicated to use. None of those are really easy to use, and they're more work than they're worth, I think. Usually castor oil is the main ingredient, and it must be watered into the soil. Just stamping down the tunnels as persistently as they build them is my own personal approach. Now, voles. They not only eat veggies, they spend more of their time above ground. Their problem issues are that they girdle young trees by gnawing off their bark. You can identify the damage visually as to the type of marks the animal leaves. If the marks are at the ground line and in irregular patches, it's a vole. The other vole damage is those surface trails you find in the spring when the snow melts. They've been tunneling under the snow and dining on the grass and seed available at the surface. Control includes mouse traps and repellents, and if the damage is primarily on trees, there are several types of tree guards available for a physical barrier.
Thank you for listening to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, with offices in Hudson in Columbia County and Acre in Greene County. You can learn more about Cornell Cooperative by visiting the website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. If you have a gardening question or would like to suggest a topic for a future radio show, you can also email us at colgremg@cornell.edu. Today's topic is defensive gardening, and we're joined by Jean Thomas, a Master Gardener volunteer, and one of our movers and shakers in Greene County. Let's dig right back in, shall we?
Sure. So, Jean, you talked about Disney characters early with Chip and Dale, chipmunks. What about Thumper? Let's talk about rabbits.
Thumper. There's another cute Disney type. Actually, I'm thinking they're more like a Warner Brothers cartoon. My hero is Bugs Bunny. They're wise guys, and they usually outsmart us. Fortunately, they have lots of natural predators to keep the population down. They'll eat anything, and I'm told anything except tomatoes. And I guess there are some other vegetables that they're not terribly interested in. Teresa, do you have a list available?
Yeah, other vegetables they supposedly don't like as much is artichoke, asparagus, onion, some peppers, potato, squash, and tomatoes are on the list. They tend to avoid plants with either strong fragrance or fuzzy leaves. In that case, they're similar to deer. But then there's also some trees and shrubs. They don't like black walnut, juniper, spruce, azalea, or fir. And there's a wide range of annuals and perennials. So things like allium, they don't like, just like the deer. But balloon flowers, bee balm, begonia, black-eyed Susan, blanket flowers, bleeding heart, mums, petunias, rosemary, a lot of herbs. So there's a lot of options that you can live and coexist with rabbits without having too much trouble.
And they also do not like one of the favorite edge rows of marigolds. They really don't like marigolds.
Ooh, good to know, because I love marigolds. Well, in the winter, they browse on woody plants, other than the ones that Teresa mentioned. And you can identify their damage. I know a lot of times you see something's chomped on and you say, oh, the deer did it, or oh, somebody did it, whatever the most recent critter you've seen go by. The rabbits gnaw differently than deer. Their height is usually within the first 2.5 feet above ground, except when there's a snow cover. Then it's 2.5 feet above the height of the snow. So in the winter, you may see the damage done by 12-foot-tall rabbits. Also, the clipping of the stems is clean-cut and angular, as opposed to the torn and jagged edges the deer leave. It has to do with their different structure of their teeth. I know the deer just chew with their lower teeth, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Best practice with these guys, with the rabbits, is to use fences and tree wraps if you've got a big population going on. Population control is nearly impossible. Repellents will work short-term, but they're most effective if you want to protect a ripening crop. So if you've got something that's getting ready to come in, that might be the time that you want to go out and spray with a repellent that is approved for food crops. Trapping isn't viable, and poisons are never a good choice. A poisoned rabbit becomes food for some other animal and goes up the food chain, and you're doing a whole lot more damage than good. Hunting is a time-honored system if you're in an area approved for hunting, but it's probably not practical for most of us.
Yeah, repellents might actually be the best bet because rabbits have a natural inclination towards nocturnal activity. And so that's why, you may see them around during the day, the reality is they're kind of hard to actually catch because they're around at night. So
what about woodchucks?
At last, there's one that's not so stinking cute. Unless you're a fan of Punxsutawney Phil. These are great tunnel builders, and they're always hungry. If one has found your garden or orchard, the battle is personal. They establish residency, and they forage from their home base. Teresa, you told me, I think, that there is a list of resistant plants for the woodchucks?
Yeah, we have a list of groundhog-resistant plants on our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org, but I'll give you just a couple of vegetables. It's beets, fennel, onions, and potatoes. The evergreens, it's blue spruce, Japanese holly, juniper, and pines. Shrubs are forsythia, lilac, rose of Sharon, wisteria. Shade plants are things like bleeding heart, foxglove, hellebore, lily of the valley, wild ginger. So one more time, there are options you can plant and coexist with your woodchuck neighbor.
Okay, if you are in their range and you've got the woodchuck under the outhouse, which is where mine lives, you are under attack. Shooting and trapping are subject to many regulations and difficult for the home. Habitat traps work, but are a disposal problem. There's rules and regulations to do with that, where you can release the animal, but it has to be on your own property. That really never works, because he's back home before you are. So and you're not allowed to kill them, and there are all kinds of things going on. There are no repellents listed for woodchucks. Apparently, you can't offend one. And fencing has to be following particular steps. If you've got a real battle going on, as a minimum, if you're doing fencing, they have to be about a foot underground and have the top edge leaning outward away from the fenced area because, oh, by the way, woodchucks climb very well, too. Electric fencing is strongly encouraged in many cases, but bear in mind, Teresa has mentioned some of the drawbacks to that with the electric fencing. You can try to make their environment less hospitable by clearing brush and areas around your property away from the house so that they have less places to start their base from, potential sheltering spots. The problem with that is if you want to encourage other wildlife, then you've made it less hospitable for them as well. So woodchucks are a really big challenge, and I just found out recently, in fact, they're related to beavers. So here's a little tidbit of trivia. Beavers and woodchucks both have, what was the percentage? It's a certain amount of inches of teeth.
They got 4 incisor teeth that grow at 1/16 of an inch a week.
And they must gnaw constantly to keep from their teeth from outgrowing their face. So they have their problems too.
A couple of other interesting factoids about woodchucks is that most of them have summer and winter dens. Oh. And they're rarely far from a burrow entrance, which makes them, again, very difficult to catch. The burrows can be large with up to 46 feet of tunnels.
Oh, my.
Up to 5 feet underground.
No wonder why we get all those calls.
And that's why the bombs and the smoke things and the gum, my favorite, the gum, don't usually work.
It's also another little factoid is they're one of the few species to enter into true hibernation from October to March or April. Their body temperature can drop down to 35 degrees Fahrenheit with a heart rate of only 4 to 10 beats a minute. That actually is pretty amazing.
Hmm.
So despite the fact that they're a nuisance, they also are actually pretty amazing animals.
Well, talking about hibernation, you think chipmunks hibernate? Yeah, they do for about 10 minutes at a time, so don't be counting on them to go into any drastic amount of hibernation. They're always going to, if there's a warm spell, the chipmunks will come popping up and running around without acorns in their cute little cheeks.
Yeah, the fun part with the chipmunks is that they always seem to forget where they hid their acorns, and then you're in the garden the next spring and you're pulling out all these seedlings.
Well, that brings up the subject of squirrels. We're not talking about squirrels today, other than the fact that they are related to woodchucks and beavers and bury things and forget where they are and are generally about the biggest nuisance on the planet.
Usually my daffodils are the ones that are put in the middle of the yard.
Uh-huh. Where, yeah, I, they replant them. Things.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Jean and Teresa, I want to thank you. It's been a pleasure having you with us today. We'd also like to thank WGXC 90.7 Radio for hosting this program, as well as the production support from me and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this edition of Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program of Cornell Cooperative Extension, by checking out our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. You can contact us by emailing us at colgremg@cornell.edu. We can also be found on Facebook as Master Gardeners of Columbia and Green Counties. Master Gardener volunteers are typically available on Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays in the Hudson office, or on Tuesday and Thursday mornings in the Acre office. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, inch by inch, row by row, let's help your garden grow.
Find my way in nature's chain, and tune my body and my brain to the music from the land. An inch this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. Inch by inch and row by row, someone blessed these seeds I sowed. Someone warmed them from below till the rains come tumbling down.
Welcome back to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. This program is broadcast by courtesy of WGXC Radio 90.7 FM. I'm Teresa Golden, and with me is Jean Thomas. The topic for this segment is a year in the life of a master gardener, and with us is Donna Peterson, Master Gardener Volunteer Coordinator. Welcome, Donna. Thanks for having here.
Thanks for having me back again.
We can do that whenever. Welcome, Donna. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me back to speak to you.
Okay, Donna, let's start with a little description of what the Master Gardener Volunteer Program is before we go into a description of a year in the life. It's conducted by Cornell Cooperative Extension. Is it totally volunteer operated?
Yes. The Master Gardener Program is run under the Community Horticultural Program and is totally volunteer run with the guidance of the CCE coordinator, myself, and a hort educator, which I am as well. And this year, well, last year, I should say, 2019, the Master Gardeners put in over 6,000 hours of volunteer time.
Okay, so there has to be a sequence of events and workshops to accumulate those hours through the calendar year, not just the outdoor growing season.
Yes, there is. Some of our annual program consists of major events like our seed starting workshops, home fruit pruning programs, spring gardening day, which is the major one, and fundraisers like our plant sales.
Okay, let's proceed throughout the year. The first big event is the first part of April, Spring Garden Day. Want to fill us in a little more on exactly what that involves?
Yes, Spring Gardening Day is our major event. This year, held on April 4th, 2020, and is held at Columbia Greene Community College, one of our partners. At this event, a registrant can attend three of 18 this year, hour-long lectures in three sessions. We have a keynote speaker, Adam Wheeler, who is a top vendor for Margaret Roach at one of her annual events. We have food at this event, breakfast and lunch. You can purchase. You can shop at vendors that we have or participate in our auction, where many unique items, from gardening items to art and gift certificates, will be available to bid on. There's something for everyone at that event. Registration will be opening at the early part of February, so go to our website or call our offices for more information. We sold out last year, 3 weeks prior to the event, so don't be left out. Make sure you register early.
How many registrants are you allowed?
This year we're opening up and broadening from 125 to 150. So don't be left out as a walk-in, because we'll have limited, if no, availability for that at all.
Okay, and the classes are mostly taught by master gardeners, plus we have instructors in from different professional lines.
That's correct. We do. We have most of our master gardeners, because they do these types of programs for other events like garden clubs and all. They will be doing those classes. And then we have a smattering of outside lecturers who come in, some from other cooperative extensions.
Okay. And Spring Gardening Day might be an opportunity for the gardeners among our listeners, if they're interested in becoming master gardeners. That information will be available somewhere for them.
Absolutely. Or they can call me at either office, and I will be more than happy to send them a packet of information. If, from what you've been hearing on our great radio station and have attended any other of our events, and you're interested in becoming a master gardener, we will be having a training this year, and it will be in September.
Okay, it starts in September, and what is it, 60 or 70 hours of class?
It's usually about that. We have, I think it's 16 classes. It will start from September, should end around the mid-December, and at which time after that you'll have to perform and be involved for 75 hours of volunteer service before you can get your certification that you are and have become one of our interviewees, Master Gardeners Extraordinaire.
You are listening to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties with offices in Hudson, in Columbia County, and Acre in Greene County. You can learn more about the Cooperative Extension by visiting the website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. You can also email us at colgremg@cornell.edu. The topic for this segment is A Year in the Life of a Master Gardener, and we're joined by Donna Peterson, Master Gardener Volunteer Coordinator. Let's dig right back in. So, Donna, barring a few seed-starting workshops and gardener training, what happens after the Spring Gardening Day excitement?
Well, we have our spring plant sales at both sites. That is a fundraiser. Each office has plants that have been raised from seeds or cuttings in sterile mix. Remember, we had talked, or if you heard about the jumping worm, that's the reason why we stopped our swaps. So it's in that jumping worm was available too much, so we didn't want to spread them around. We raise our cuttings in sterile mix, and they will be for sale. The plants range from vegetables and herbs to native perennials.
Okay, and I know that we have several, talk about partners, professional growers in the area who are donating plants for us to sell as well. So there will be mature plants other than the seedlings.
Absolutely.
Okay. Can I assume that there's going to be lots of garden clubs and library groups and community garden groups looking for speakers from all these master gardeners with all the, in between all the regularly scheduled events?
Absolutely.
Is there a speakers bureau?
Yes, we are formulating a speakers bureau. And for those that can't afford, we're looking for minimal contributions for this type of speakers bureau. But we have a large range of master gardeners who are willing to go out and do this. And it will be available to groups like community gardens and garden clubs if they want to give me a call. I'll be happy to pass that out.
Okay, so there's a library of lectures and talks available. So if a garden club's interested in seed starting or somebody else is interested in pruning, they can call and maybe we can set them up with a speaker.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So with all this activity, do master gardener volunteers relax in the summer?
Oh, no. Usually that's when all our local gardeners are out there. And when they're out there, that's when we get all the questions that we get at our offices. Phone calls come in, emails start gearing up. So they may say an insect that they don't know, something's wrong with their tomato seeds, that you know, tomato plants that they're growing. What's this plant that's now there? This is where we identify a lot of the invasive species. We calm people down and give them good scientifically backed up proof that this is what you need to do to handle any problems that come up.
So it's not just gardening issues, it's environmental.
Absolutely.
That's a bigger range than just what's in your veggie garden.
Absolutely. Okay. What we try to do is make everyone good stewards of their environment. So when that happens, everybody's happy and we all live, you know, happier lives. You've got happy plants, we're very happy.
Okay, so at the end of the summer, things crank up again?
Oh, yes. The Master Gardeners at that time have an interactive display at our local fairs. So in July, at the end of July, it's the Greene County Youth Fair that they will have a display at. And Labor Day weekend is the Columbia County Fair.
Let me interrupt.
Go ahead.
Youth Fair is free.
Youth Fair is free, yes. The Columbia County is not. However, both fairs are a must-go to see what the Master Gardeners have displayed. Like I said, both interactive, both are great. Lots of Master Gardeners in attendance, lots of answers and questions, programs that are available all the time.
Are there any more festivities after harvest time?
Yes. What we usually try to close with is our wreath workshop. It's held at both sites with limited attendance. Unfortunately, we can't accommodate too many more than 15 at each site. And it's a lot of work for the Master Gardeners, but always a lot of fun for both the attendees and Master Gardeners.
Thank you, Donna. We're so grateful you were able to join us today. We'd also like to thank WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for hosting this program and for the production support that was provided by Donna Peterson and Devin Connolly from the Cornell Cooperative Extension. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this edition of Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. You can learn more about Cornell Cooperative Extension by checking out our website at ccecolumbiagreene.org. If there are topics or questions you'd like us to answer on future episodes of this show, email us at colgremg@cornell.edu and include radio show in the subject title. You can contact us with any other questions also by emailing us at colgremg@cornell.edu. Master Gardeners are typically available on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday in the Hudson office or on Tuesday and Thursday morning in the ACRA office. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, inch by inch, row by row, let us help your garden grow.
You can contact Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties with questions at ccecolumbiagreene.org, visit us in Hudson or in ACRA, or ask us questions on the Master Gardeners of CCE Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook group. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal program and employment opportunities. Someone warm them from below till the rains come.